Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We've been devoting a lot of time to tracking the local and statewide consequences of the many funding and staffing cuts occurring in Washington and outlying federal offices, and that work will continue in the weeks ahead. But even as we process these events, concerns, and distractions, life does go on in the meantime. So this week we're shifting focus to other matters, such as the statewide problem Eastern Standard contributor Natalie Voss explores in her latest installment.
I am here with Deborah Hamelback, Executive Director of the Kentucky Veterinary Medical Association. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you very much, Natalie, for having me on.
Now, we're here to talk about something that a lot of people may not realize. It seems like about every block or so there's a veterinary clinic. If you have a cat or a dog, it seems like you've got plenty of options there. But there's actually a veterinary shortage in many places in the country, including Kentucky. So where is this shortage happening, and what species, what animals is it impacting?
Sure. You know, how we really figured this out here in Kentucky that, you know, we are not unlike the rest of the United States. We do have a rural veterinary shortage. What we did about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, is we worked with our licensing board, the Kentucky Board of Veterinary Examiners, to modernize the Practice Act. And that is how veterinarians practice their veterinary medicine in their statutes and regulation. And so we worked through that for a 2-year process. And, you know, a lot of different things came out of the Practice Act. It was passed through the legislature. Many, many good things. But one thing that did come out of it is that we do have a rural veterinary shortage here in Kentucky. And so then Commissioner Ryan Quarles and his chief of staff, Keith Rogers, they decided to put together a veterinary shortage working group. And so over the course of 18 months, all the commodity groups, you name it, it'd be pork, soybean, cattle, equine, we all got together. And there was about 25 of us that broke out into 4 groups. And we really came together and really identified areas of need throughout Kentucky. And one of the main ones that came out, and we're going to talk about that today, is the student loan repayment program. And so we're very proud of that fact. KVMA led the way for that. To go back to the question, though, it's primarily the shortage areas are in the rural areas. It's usually the little bit less populated areas. It's harder for a veterinarian to make a living full time in some of these areas. And then where it really is affecting them is your cattle, your equine. Equine, you don't think about that living in Kentucky, but when you get out to rural Kentucky, we still have a lot of horses out there. And then, of course, your sheep and goats, your non-ruminants.
So many people may not realize the life of a large animal veterinarian, especially out in the country, is pretty different than what you might experience when you take your dog or your cat into the vet.
Right.
What is challenging about that lifestyle if you're a vet who's sort of out, you're mobile, you're going to the animals that right. are needing your help? Why is this life kind of challenging?
You mentioned that they have to go out to the farms. There are more veterinary clinics that are trying to have haul-in services, but when you have to do an overall herd call and take a look at all of them, of course, you need to go out there. A lot of times in rural areas of Kentucky, if you've driven out into eastern, southern, western Kentucky, the farms could be 45 minutes to an hour apart. So that entails a lot of drive time. Whereas if you're in a small animal clinic, you're scheduled every 15 to 20 minutes with appointments. And so you are not having the income that you would in a small animal type of practice. And so those are huge differences right there. The other part is physical demands. Our demographic in the veterinary profession has changed in the last 10 to 20, 25 years. It is more prominently female. You know, when you're working with cattle, you're working with horses, you don't really know their temperament, but it can be physically demanding. And so, you know, a female veterinarian will go out with good intentions, and we have wonderful female veterinarians. So please don't think I'm saying anything, you know, negative towards that. But it is a physically demanding job. And when you're working in cattle chutes, you know, and horses and stocks and all of that. And so that's one other area. And then there is just an emotional toll. They do have a work-life balance that's a little bit different than their colleagues in the small animal space. And so one thing to note is that an average herd of cattle is 28. And so I found that very interesting. We, like, as I said, we work with many different producers and commodity groups. We work well with the Kentucky Cattlemen's Association. And it is an average of 68% of producers actually work outside of the farm. We found that this is one of those issues that they're working. And so when they are actually scheduling the veterinarian, it's usually after hours or before hours or weekends. And so that is another thing. You know, veterinarians do try to have a family and try to have some family time, too. And so that can be a frustration for the producer and the veterinarian as far as scheduling those calls.
What are some of the real world impacts that the KVMA is seeing as a result of that shortage? Obviously, if there's not as many veterinarians to see horses, it's an issue for horse owners, but then you've got food animals too. So what are the consequences that you guys are seeing of this problem?
Honestly, it's delayed access to care, and those producers or equine owners need to wait longer to get their veterinarians. One thing that, as I said, we're working alongside KCA is that it has to be a two-way street. So cattle producers, they need to utilize their veterinarian. They need to utilize them as their, you know, resource. They need to not just call them when there is an emergency or at midnight on a holiday. And they'll be honest with you and say, yes, I'm guilty of that. You know, that veterinarian doesn't want to be called out, you know, once every 2 years when he doesn't really have what we call a VCPR, which is your veterinary client-patient relationship. It needs to technically be established with an in-person visit or an on-site farm herd visit. And so those are things that can really help the relationship between a producer and a veterinarian, is to know that they are being utilized throughout the year, not just when emergencies arise. The other part is that, you know, it's increased workload for those existing veterinarians. Many of them work mixed animal. And so we have over 300 mixed animal veterinarians throughout Kentucky, and several of them, to make ends meet, work mixed animal. So a lot of times they'll see small animals in the morning, they'll do surgery, and then they'll block themselves out for 2 to 4 to 5 hours in the afternoon into the evening so they can do their farm calls, because they do not charge as much on those farm calls and when they're seeing the producers, because the margins are so much lower. So that is one of the things that we do find when you're in a rural mixed animal setting, is that your hours are longer than they are if you're in a small animal clinic here in Lexington, typically. The other part of it is, you know, we do have animal health and food supply concerns. You know, when you're working in the rural large animal setting, that's the food that we eat. And right now we have been dealing with avian influenza. It's all over the media. It's not going to go away. And, you know, it's affected dairy herds. Kentucky right now is lucky. We've not had that happen here. But we need to be very cognizant that our cattle, our poultry, the, you know, the food that we eat is taken care of and well taken care of by our veterinarians.
Now, on the equine side, I'm aware that they have a problem both with practitioners who've been in it a long time or getting to retirement age, mm-hmm. but then also they'll have new people come in who are only staying in for a few years before they kind of see these hours and income imbalances and then leaving. So how is the KVMA sort of trying to address the causes of this shortage and then also these sort of different demographics of veterinarians that you're dealing with who were involved in the shortage?
Right. That's a great question, because it is proven that as a bovine practitioner and an equine practitioner, basically the transition is about 5 years. That's where the burnout happens, and that comes from the AAEP, so the Equine Practitioners American Association, and the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. And so that burnout happens within about 5 years. And so I think that where we are as KVMA, looking at it within the state, regionally, nationally, is we really need to identify those students. We need to identify them in middle school, high school, those that come from a rural background that want to go back out and work into that rural background or with the horses, whether it be on the racetrack or the farms, because it's a culture, it's a lifestyle, it's different than, you know, your 9-to-5 job. And not all small animal clinics, I want to just say that small animal clinics take emergencies, they're working more than 9-to-5, but it is more of a lifestyle rather than a career. And so one of the things that we've done with the Kentucky Cattlemen's, with Auburn CVM, where we have our contract seats and through our KVMA Foundation, is we are actually looking at these high school juniors and seniors. They write out applications, and the Kentucky Cattlemen's actually, they look at the applications. We had a review committee. We had enough funding with grants and donations to sponsor 10 of these high school seniors. And I'll tell you, I was on this committee, and these are some impressive young individuals. They get to come to our KVMA conference, our annual state conference. They get to go to the Kentucky Cattlemen's Conference. They get to get mentored with an Auburn veterinary student that's a Kentucky resident. So they get to go down there. And what we're going to really do is follow them along while they're in pre-vet, whatever university they're going to. And, you know, they've already met everybody that's down at Auburn or Tuskegee, where we have contract seats. And this is a program that we're 3 years into it. And we really look forward to following this and hopefully getting those students into veterinary school and then back home in those rural areas. That's what several other states are doing, too. And we're all collectively wanting to see how well this will work.
So I know that there's also a veterinary loan repayment program
Yes.
that you guys have worked on, because obviously veterinary school, like any graduate program, is very expensive. And if you were graduating with all this debt and then you're going into a field that doesn't pay as well, then that might be part of the cause for the burnout. So what can you tell me about that?
That is the number one cause. And so it's literally the rural area, they just do not make as much income. And so the vast majority of students getting out of veterinary school have an average of $152,000. Our average for our Kentucky residents, because they get to pay in-state tuition at Auburn, is right in that same area, $125 to $150. So it is literally a student debt to income ratio. Students want to go back home. They want to go back home to the rural areas and work. And sometimes with some of the corporate entities, they have big bonuses, sign-on bonuses. You know, they're like, okay, I'm going to go do this for a few years and then see if I can go back home. We do have several that have done that. But the number one final item that we realized from our vet shortage working group in that what works is having your own in-state student loan repayment program. And Kentucky did that. KVMA led the way last year. We had amazing support. We have the Kentucky Department of Agriculture and the General Assembly split the funds. We looked at several other state programs, and we tried to blend what we thought would be the best. So we had 27 applicants for the five spots last year, and it's a five-year program, five-year commitment. And every year they work, they receive funding, and it goes directly towards their student loans. And at the end of the 5 years, they will have earned $87,500 off of their student loan. This program works. Now we are up to 25 states that have this program, with six more in the pipeline and legislation sessions. Honestly, we'd like to expand that program. You know, if we had 27 apply for five spots, you know, and they are going out to the specific rural areas on our map, we could help solve this problem within 3 to 4 years. One thing that we know from data is if somebody stays in a community for 5 years, they tend to meet people. They tend to possibly even meet a spouse. They join a chamber. They join a church, or, you know, they get assimilated. They become part of the community. And so 5 years was a very specific number of why that, you know, we wanted that number of them for the student loan repayment program. We're very proud of this. We want to be able to see this continue and expand. So we've got support, you know, throughout the state, and we're very proud of this program.
Well, Deborah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on and telling us all about this.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me.
Daily Yonder reporter Ilana Newman is hosting Getaway. It's a new five-part podcast series about outdoor recreation economies and how rural communities and small towns deal with tourism, the problems, the solutions, the benefits. Ilana's based in Colorado, but one of those episodes features Fayetteville, West Virginia, and the New River Gorge National Park, the latest addition to the national park system. We wanted to check with Ilana to see if there are any lessons from her New River experience that might apply closer to home, places like the Red River Gorge. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Ilana.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So first, tell us about the podcast series. Who have you talked to?
I have talked to so many different people across the country, everyone from academics and economists who study this for a living to city managers and residents in small towns whose towns rely on recreation for their main economy, and some places that don't necessarily rely on recreation but are looking to build their recreation economy to support a declining mining or agriculture industry.
Well, a declining mining community certainly applies to our coverage area, which is Eastern Kentucky. And there is talk in Eastern Kentucky about developing a tourism industry. Why should rural regions devote themselves to tourism-based development?
Well, tourism is definitely seen as this potential savior for especially mining communities, but also logging and agriculture and other sorts of extractive industries to kind of move towards tourism, because a lot of times these places, our rural communities, have a lot of natural amenities, whether that's trails and forests or rivers or mountains or places that people want to go to be outside and enjoy themselves and recreate, or as a tourist destination. But there are definitely challenges that come with having a tourism-based economy. Tourism can also boom and bust, just like coal or other types of mining can. So it's not necessarily a perfect solution to a declining mining community, but it can be a potential option to strengthen an economy and provide some more stability for an industry like mining that might be going downhill. I think one of the biggest things that's important when it comes to planning and thinking about developing a recreation economy is that piece of planning and preparing ahead of time for an influx of visitors and making sure that the community really wants this and it's not coming from an outside entity, like someone saying, this is what you need in your community. It really has to be driven from a small town and be developed and planned for by the people in that community.
One of the big, big issues can be housing.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest challenges when it comes to developing a recreation economy, is that once these places become attractive, they attract second homeowners who maybe live there for a week, a year, and otherwise rent out their property. And then that becomes a short-term rental. So tourists are able to pay those high prices, but then the workforce is struggling to find a place to live. And then that pushes the workforce out. And oftentimes they're commuting in from other counties and unable to find an affordable place to live within the community that they work. So that's one of the biggest challenges. And I think that's one of the biggest ways that communities can plan ahead and prepare for these potential issues down the road. If you're not already dealing with high costs of housing, which most of the country is, just over the past 5 years, housing costs have increased everywhere. But if that's compounded with an increase in visitors and second homeowners and short-term rentals, then that can be even more challenging on a small community and eventually creates a lack of culture, and the history of that community might leave if they're driven out by high housing prices, which can be really detrimental for the culture and economy of a small town. But there are ways for communities to implement policies, restrictions on short-term rentals, and taxes on lodging that can help support that economy and provide a balance between having a workforce and also having a strong tourism economy. One of the communities I looked at was Moab, Utah, which is already dealing with a huge cost of living issue where people in the community who work there can't necessarily afford to live there. A lot of people are living in vehicles, working there seasonally and unable to find housing. And they have a really special program. The Moab Community Land Trust has land that they were very graciously gifted by a donor, and they are building properties on that land, and the community land trust owns the land, but the property owner owns the buildings on top of the land. So that's a way to keep housing prices cheaper for residents and provide a stable place to live without necessarily having it be market price, because it's cheaper for them to build it because they're not necessarily including the cost of land. So there can also be ways to keep houses from going up in price by market rate and other policy tools that can be used to keep housing affordable. And it really is important to have that, again, driven by the community and have those organizations locally based.
in mining communities, for example, moving away from an extractive industry? Is there a possibility of just trading one for another extractive industry when it comes to tourism?
Yeah, I think that is definitely a risk. And really, that comes down to you don't necessarily want all of your economy to be in one industry, no matter what it is, because then you're at risk of if that industry goes bust, then you're kind of out of luck. And that can definitely happen with tourism. Some of the extractive risks of tourism could look like your visitors not necessarily taking care of the land that you live on and not necessarily being respectful of the town and the surrounding natural amenities like forests and rivers and mountains. And then also that aspect of that culture and history and community leaving the town if there's not necessarily restrictions put in place to keep the workforce in that community.
As I mentioned earlier, there is a lot of interest, a lot of discussion in Southeast Kentucky about finding a way to capitalize on the region. It is a beautiful area. It's been scarred by mountaintop removal and other issues. But what are some practices that a rural community in a place like Southeast Kentucky has to think about, has to adopt and then sustain on their way to transforming into a place that tourists would consider a destination they would want to visit?
I think that, like I said, there's a lot of ways that it needs to really be driven by the community. So having planners in place within towns and working together with a state or local tourism board, that's a way to kind of develop sustainable practices and concepts for the future of a community. And really having it driven by the community. You know, West Virginia has a program where they're incentivizing people to move to small towns with grants. You get the grant after you've been there for 2 years. So that's something that the Fayetteville area has, and people are moving to the area because they want to be in a small town and have access to the outdoors. And so they're taking advantage of these programs. And that's something that the West Virginia Economic Development and Tourism and all these different organizations have come together to create this program that is incentivizing people to move there and also developing the tourism and recreation economy as it all working together.
How important to a community's success as a tourism destination is access, roads, or proximity to airports?
You know, I think infrastructure is a big part of it. Being close to an airport is important, but I think sometimes having a designation like a national park or a national monument or a national river or even a national forest can bring people to an area that might be considered a road trip destination. So I don't necessarily think that you have to be close to an airport to have good tourism access, but it's definitely a consideration. Some of these more remote places might not be as easy to promote as something that you can fly to or is a couple hours from a bigger city for sure. But yeah, planning for that infrastructure is a big piece of it. Having trails, developing trails that bring people to the same places, having bathrooms, having roads to get you there that are maintained, that's all really important. And that kind of comes from that planning and land management piece of it. So working together with government, city, land management agencies, that's kind of a big piece of creating the infrastructure to support tourism as well.
Well, you certainly cover this and a lot more in your podcast series. Where can we find it?
You can find our podcast on the Rural Remix channel, wherever you get your podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever. And the podcast is called Getaway.
And that is Daily Yonder reporter Ilana Newman, host of Getaway. It's that new 5-part podcast series on outdoor recreation economies and how rural communities and small towns deal with tourism. Thanks so much, Ilana.
Thanks for having me.
Ilana Newman mentioned how important it is for a city or town that wants to draw tourists to recognize and preserve its history. That's not lost on Lexington, now celebrating 250 years of history. And if a town could talk, well, it actually can if it has somebody tending to its story, and that somebody is here with us. Mandy Higgins is in charge of things at the Lexington History Museum, and she's joining us monthly, each time highlighting a particular exhibit. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Mandy.
Thank you for having me.
The Woman's Club of Central Kentucky is what we're going to talk about today. It's in its 131st year in Lexington. The Women's Club helped bring the Carnegie Library and Lexington Public Library into existence, helped women's suffrage, passed anti-spitting ordinances, we'll have to talk about that, and pushed Lexington to adopt standard time. Early members included Madeline McDowell Breckenridge. Let's talk about the Women's Club of Central Kentucky. What can you tell us?
I love talking about the Women's Club of Central Kentucky. So I should preface this with we have a full exhibit dedicated just to the Women's Club of Central Kentucky. It's on display through March for Women's History Month. The club itself was started in 1894 by a group of well-established and well-connected white women in town who wanted a place to gather for educational and philanthropic purposes. They wanted to be together to better the city and to better themselves. They were pooled their membership from a number of other clubs. There are other women's clubs still in existence, and then some that have fallen off in the years. And they started meeting and had, you know, like all clubs do, like 18 different units of, we have an education and there's a music and there's a whatever and a whatever and whatever. But they met regularly every week to learn something new about Lexington, to figure out their place. And starting in that 1894, the end of 1894 through about 1930, they were really, really civically active and engaged. And then after the Depression and World War II, they move a little bit more into philanthropic work and less into that engaged civic activism. But they were still some of the leading women in town who were doing things like helping the children's theater thrive and helping to bring the Lexington Ballet into existence and those sorts of, you know, really incredible pieces, the Living Arts and Science Center. And so why the museum thinks it's important to talk about the Women's Club is because they owned the building that we are now in. In 1964, the Women's Club of Central Kentucky purchased the Thomas Hunt Morgan House and its adjoining auditorium as their clubhouse. And they stewarded it for 50 years. From 1964 to 2014, it was their clubhouse. They met there weekly. They had world-renowned speakers in to educate them about the topics of the day. And then they played bridge and did all kinds of other things. They also built the room that was at the time called the President's Room that our exhibit is in today. So they joined the Thomas Hunt Morgan House with the auditorium so that you can move between the two. Their work is often sort of under the radar, forgotten about maybe, and not as celebrated. And we can, you know, assume why that might be. And some of it is, of course, because they were women in an age when women couldn't vote or didn't have as much of a voice or couldn't own property. But it's also because they didn't seek the spotlight. And so it was really, really incredible as we were doing the research to see, oh, these women made life in Lexington possible for so many other people. And they did it quietly, and they did it without fanfare.
Well, a good example would be having something to do with the Carnegie Library in the public library.
Exactly, exactly. So Lexington had libraries before the Carnegie came. So this is the 2nd and Mill Street Carnegie Center today. This is the first public library in Lexington. Opens in 1905. Before that, the Transylvania Library had a subscription library, and so you could pay to be a member of a library to get books. And by the late 19th century, it was very clear that Lexington was A, too big, and B, needed something where you didn't have to pay so you could get materials. So the Women's Club, working with some other folks in town, petitioned Mr. Carnegie to think about bringing a library here, and worked with the town leaders, with the mayor and with the precursor to the council, which wasn't a thing then, to make sure that there was land and that they could dissolve the lending libraries into this public library system. Mm. So they bring the library in, and then we have the Lexington Public Library, who continues to do incredible work across the city. And thanks to, you know, 30 women in the late 19th century.
As I mentioned in the introduction, they did not like spitting.
They didn't. Well, okay. So give yourself back into the early 20th century. Think about women's clothing. First of all, women wore long dresses, by and large, wore long dresses, smart shoes. So their dresses were dragging. But they also lived with the memory of cholera and typhus. And we're going to talk about Madeline McDowell Breckenridge in a second, tuberculosis. And all of those diseases spread with spittle. And at the same time, people are chewing tobacco openly. They're, you know, they need to get rid of the tobacco juice, so they're spitting.
And there's spittoons all over the place.
There are spittoons all over the place, but we didn't really like to use them. And it's not just us. It's a national problem. So the women take up a letter-writing campaign, basically editorials, and go to council meetings to enforce a law that if you are caught spitting in public, particularly on public transportation or in the street, that you will be fined up to $5. The best thing about that story is the ordinance is still on the books.
Well, it may be apropos. I mean, we have some things going around.
Right. I mean, I think about it now, like if we would have, what the council could have done in COVID.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Now, before we run out of time, we have to mention Madeline McDowell Breckenridge.
Oh, Madge. Madge is beloved and well-known in Lexington. You know, she's a McDowell. She marries DeShay Breckenridge, who's the publisher of the Lexington Herald. But what is incredible to me in the story we tell in our exhibit is actually not the things that you already know about Madeline, about her suffrage work and her parks work and those sorts of things. But she builds the first tuberculosis sanatoriums in the state, and some of the earliest in the country. Madeline had tuberculosis. It infected her ankle, and she eventually lost her foot. But she knew that those suffering from tuberculosis needed a level of care that they were not going to get in their homes. And so she worked tirelessly to bring TB sanatoriums across the state. And the first one was here in Lexington at Julius Marks, which is out Georgetown Road now. So the building's still, you can still see it. And we have on display and in the collection, a brass plate that was in the sanitarium until it closed in the 60s, honoring Madeline and the work that she did.
So when somebody comes to visit the museum and they want to see the display about the Women's Club of Central Kentucky, what will they find?
When you visit the museum to see the Among Women, 130 Years of the Women's Club of Central Kentucky, you're going to experience a little bit of a timeline, but you're going to meet a woman from each era of the club's existence, starting with the first president of the Women's Club and coming all the way around to Loretta Brock Clark, who was an avid member in the 1950s until her death in the early 2000s, wrote the history of the Women's Club, was the second wife of Dr. Thomas Clark, the Kentucky historian for life. And so what we hope you take away is that all of these incredible things can happen when people come together, and that it took a single woman to think about something and then bring her friends around to make it happen, and so that you can do that too. And it doesn't all have to be super serious. We have a runway and a fashion show, but that's really an impactful work too.
Dr. Mandy Higgins is executive director of the Lexington History Museum. You'll find it at 210 North Broadway in downtown Lexington. Well worth a visit. Coming up after the break, we'll tell you about the American Printing House in Louisville and their work to publish Braille children's books.
Braille material is not that easy to come by. It can also be pretty expensive. So we wanted to offer a way to get Braille into the home so that these children can start to learn what their alphabet, what their words are going to look like.
John McGarry looks into resources for the visually impaired.
Executive Director Teresa Thomas is in her office at her computer. Council IT Training Manager Richard Sizemore is helping her with a program called Zoom Text Fusion that magnifies what's on the monitor and reads it aloud at a pace she chooses.
And as we alternate month to month between the behaviors of our dogs and cats, something felines do gets our attention this time round. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Back in mid-March, J.C. Morgan was on Eastern Standard primarily to tell us about the Dolly Parton Imagination Library. He's the state director for Kentucky. And near the end of our conversation, J.C. wanted to add this.
This is something I'm really proud of. The American Printing House, which is in Louisville, also has a Braille program. If you know of a child who has visual disabilities, and this doesn't have to be a 0 to 5-year-old, they accept children who are a little older, and also parents, because a visually impaired parent has to be able to read to their child too. So they're the same books that we give to everybody else. You can't see it, but I'm holding one up right now, and it has a sticker on it with the raised Braille. And prisoners at the women's prison there in Oldham County, they actually transcribe these books, put the stickers on, and then they mail them out all over the United States, Puerto Rico. That all comes from the American Printing House in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm really proud of that.
That's J.C. Morgan with the Dolly Parton Imagination Library. We wanted to know more about this, and with us now from Louisville is Christine Genovoli, Braille Tales Program Coordinator at the American Printing House for the Blind. Welcome, Christine.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And if you would, a little background, how did this program get started?
Well, this program has a very interesting history. The idea for it came out of Tennessee, which is very fitting given that that is where Dolly Parton's Imagination Library came from. What happened was the Imagination Library had taken off and it was getting a lot of really great support and growth. And there were teachers and administrators at the Tennessee School for the Blind that said, hey, we have this incredible program basically right in our backyard. How can we make it more accessible for our children? So they started looking around for ways to make that happen. And very long story short, they ended up reaching out to us at the American Printing House for the Blind. We are the largest nonprofit in the world serving the blind and low vision community. We have been operational since the 1850s. So we had the history, the knowledge, and the production capabilities to be able to take this program on. And when you hear someone coming to you with an idea and they say books, kids, and Dolly Parton, you say, where do I sign? And that is what got us started with it. And so we have been running this program through APH, everything right out of Louisville, Kentucky, since 2011.
Well, it might seem obvious, Christine, that a mom or dad sitting down with their child to read a book is a good thing, but why not just opt for an audiobook?
That is a very, very good question, and actually something that is a little bit of a misconception outside of the blind and low vision community. Audio is amazing. It certainly has its uses, and it's very, very important, whether you're, you know, blind or low vision or seeing. It's a great option to have, but it limits what a person can do. Because if you're relying on audio for everything, you're relying on somebody to create that audio for you, for everything. And that doesn't allow blind and low vision people the independence that they deserve, the same way a sighted person would, to exist in the world. So Braille literacy is just as important as print literacy. And that is why this program was so important for us to get involved in, to be able to help blind and low vision children have access to Braille materials to set them up for success in their life.
What does the research tell us about the benefits of having that experience of reading or having a book read to visually impaired children?
Well, it really is the same benefits that sighted children receive. You know, it is well known that reading at home, starting early, is really the best indicator for literacy and success in your life. So it really is kind of one-to-one whether you're going to be a Braille reader or a print reader in your life.
Why is reading at home especially important for a child who may one day be a Braille reader?
That's a great question. So Braille material is not that easy to come by. It can also be pretty expensive. So we wanted to offer a way to get Braille into the home so that these children can start to learn what their alphabet, what their words are going to look like. The same way a sighted child has that moment with their parents or with their guardians where they're reading their favorite book, they might not be able to read the words yet, but they're learning what their words are going to look like, what their alphabet is going to look like. And it's the same with our children that are going to become Braille readers. They get this opportunity to be exposed to their alphabet that is going to open up their whole world as they start growing, as they get into school, as they start reading more, as they start reading more difficult material. And having that foundation early is just going to be so great and so important to making sure they're successful once they reach those further levels.
Now, earlier, we heard J.C. Morgan mention that inmates at the prison in Oldham County work on the Dolly Parton books to make them work for visually impaired families. Tell us more about that.
Yes, we are very, very proud of this. So we have a prison Braille program at our local correctional facility in Piwee Valley, Kentucky. And what that is a team of inmates who are trained to become Braille transcribers. So they create Braille at all levels, kindergarten through 12, and even textbooks and training materials, things of that nature. They create that Braille that can be sent out and used in the education of the blind and low vision community. So when we took on the Braille Tales program, we said, where better to help us create this than our team of transcribers that are already creating Braille? So we put the program out there, and the women behind it are just phenomenal. They are so invested. They do such high quality work, and we are so, so proud to be able to partner with them to provide these books to the children in the program, but also teach these women at the correctional facility a skill that will help them once they're released.
How does the Braille Tales program actually work if you wanted to engage with it?
Yes, absolutely. So the program, as I mentioned, it's run entirely through Louisville, Kentucky at the American Printing House for the Blind. This program provides absolutely free print Braille books to children who are blind or low vision, or to children whose parents are blind or low vision, because we know every family has a different makeup, and we want to make sure that we're, encouraging all types of reading, whatever works best for your family. So what we do is we get the books from Dolly Parton's Imagination Library, the exact same books that are in the Imagination Library program. And what our transcribers will do is transcribe clear Braille labels and put them over each page of the Imagination Library book. This means that the book is accessible when you read it for both print and Braille readers. Once the book is transcribed and the labels are laid, they're all packed up and they are mailed directly to the family's homes every other month. So we do 6 books a year. And the children are eligible for the program from birth to age 6. They graduate out at 6 years old, and we serve the entire United States as well as all U.S. territories. So that's going to be Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, etc. So if you are part of the U.S., you can get involved in this program. Regardless of income, these books are entirely free. You will never see a bill. They will show up at your house every other month until your child turns 6 years old. All you have to do is sign up and never have to think about it again. The books will come to you.
Gosh, that's great. Well, Christine, if somebody's listening to us and they want to know more or they want to get in touch, could you give us your website address, your email?
Yes, absolutely. Please reach out at any time. We are always happy to talk to people in the program. Our website is aph.org/braille-tales. Or you can email us directly at brailletales@aph.org. And like I said, reach out at any time. We are always happy to talk about the program.
All right. That's Christine Genovoli, Braille Tales Program Coordinator at the American Printing House for the Blind in Louisville. Thanks, Christine.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Loss of vision, even if partial, is life-altering. I can speak with a little bit of authority about that, thanks to a case of shingles in my right eye. And I know of plenty of others in my orbit who've experienced deteriorating eyesight. But as John McGarry tells us, there's plenty of help available in Lexington.
So let's see if we can find out what magnification you do need here. I've got a big old bin full of magnifiers.
Ann Spurlock has come to the Bluegrass Council of the Blind for help. She says the pace of her macular degeneration is quickening, and the injections that once helped now don't. Charlotte Hunt, her friend of nearly 50 years, and in recent years, her driver, is with her in the office of Sam Seavey. Sam runs the council's assistive technology program. He has macular degeneration too, but his was caused by Stargardt disease, diagnosed before he was a teenager. Some peripheral vision is about all he has left. He started volunteering here 8 years ago.
It's very much like doing an apprenticeship. You learn from someone else that's already figured it out. And so that's where we come into play. We tell them that you're going to be able to do all the things that you want to do. You're just going to have to do them in a slightly different way than you were doing them before.
While Sam and Ann test her limits and explore her abilities,
shortcut that's pinned to the taskbar.
Executive Director Teresa Thomas is in her office at her computer. Council IT Training Manager Richard Sizemore is helping her with a program called Zoom Text Fusion that magnifies what's on the monitor and reads it aloud at a pace she chooses.
So let's press H for heading.
I'm in the website and I just do H.
Like Sam, Teresa has Stargardt's disease, diagnosed at about the same age as his. Richard is also visually challenged, though he says despite scarring of his optic nerves and a condition that causes eye twitching, his vision is improving. Teresa can't say the same. Hers is all but gone, but her sense of humor is very much present.
When I look directly at you, I see your shoulders and your chest and the table.
So what I hear you saying is I didn't have to shave today.
You did not. Did you shave?
Teresa is the mother of three now adult children, but for 8 years, when they were growing up, she was a single mom. She credits her faith for much of what she did, and still does.
Okay, so that has helped you, obviously, but haven't you sometimes said, God, fix this, or God, why me?
Oh, absolutely. Don't we all, no matter what we're facing, don't we all at sometimes wonder, why me, or why has it gotten to this point? But the Bible tells us in this world we will have trouble, but take heart.
In another office is Peer Support Program Manager Susan Ament. She was born with cataracts and can't drive, but compared to Teresa and Sam, she sees pretty well. She runs the council's regular in-person lunch and learn gatherings and virtual meetings, as well as their community outings.
We have gone to coffee shops. We have gone to Wood Songs, Old Time Radio Hour. We have an audio-described dance performance coming up in February that we're planning on, and I'm excited about that. We're going on a nature walk next month.
Client and board member Kimberly May, diagnosed with glaucoma and hearing loss as a toddler, is a regular at these gatherings.
I have the chance to be around other people who have blindness or visual impairments, and we can talk about the challenges we face and our achievements.
Kimberly has been a preschool and kindergarten substitute paraeducator for 21 years. Sam and Ann's session goes long, as his often do, and before she and Charlotte leave, she's asked a question using a four-letter word, beginning with the letter H, often employed by the men and women of the Bluegrass Council of the Blind.
Do you have more hope?
Yes, I do. And I feel better about things that he explained to me.
I'm John McGarry in Lexington.
We have this monthly series going on here on Eastern Standard about our dogs and cats and why they do the things they do. They can be pretty mystified. And we invite you to send in a question if you're mystified by something. Just email it to es@eku.edu. This month's question is for Berea College cat cognition researcher Rebecca Singer. Rebecca, we have a question from Sally Horowitz and Stan Ingold. Stan's question first, but they both relate, so we're going to do them both in this segment. Stan asks, why do cats feel the need to always bury their waste? And Sally wants to know, she says, my cat has never learned to bury her poop. She scratches the side of the litter box instead of the litter itself. What's going on there?
Great question. So cats bury their waste because they hide it from predators. When they're out living in the wild and they defecate or pee somewhere, then they need to cover up that scent to keep themselves safe from predators. So this is probably a behavior that is in domesticated cats, just a leftover of their wild counterparts. Why do cats sometimes do it and sometimes not? Lots of possibilities. Your veterinarian would most likely say, check their poop before you go to any other answers. It could be that they're leaving it uncovered because there's a problem. And so even though it's a little bit of a messy business, you should take the time to just take a look and see if it looks normal or not. If it does, then you can look at behavioral answers. We know that cats have scent glands all over their bodies, and they actually have scent glands in each of the four pads of their paws. So a lot of times cats will scratch the edge of the litter box, the wall, the air in front of their litter box. My cats actually have scratched through the litter mat pads that you can put in front of a litter box. Mm-hmm. They have scratched through two of those all the way down to the floor. And it is likely that they are scent marking using those interdigital scent glands at the bottom of their paws.
Berea College cat cognition researcher Rebecca Singer. And again, we invite you to send in a dog or cat behavior question. Just email it to es@eku.edu and put dog or cat in the subject line so we'll know what it's about. Rebecca will take your cat query. Ellen Furlong, a dog cognition researcher at Transylvania, is our canine behavior guru, and we'll run something by her next month. Thanks for being with us this hour. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog and greeter. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.